and welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Perhaps no other land in history has entranced and mystified people more than Atlantis. But did Atlantis ever really exist? If not, who started the legend and why? In a moment, Creighton historian Eileen Dugan will explore these questions and more in our interview of the week. But first, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. On March 4, 1789, the Constitution of the United States went into effect, when Congress convened for the first time. After 6 years of bloody revolution, internal turmoil, and one failed frame of government, America had a new constitution and national government, which they hoped would finally mold the 13 former colonies into a new nation. So what happened on the first day of Congress? Nothing. Congress adjourned for lack of a quorum. Turning to items of interest in the news, recent disclosures in a legal case over the ownership and value of files seized from Richard Nixon by the government have revealed that the overwhelming reaction and support for President Nixon's great silent majority speech in 1969 was largely contrived. When he called on the silent majority to support the Vietnam War, Nixon wanted to make sure they responded. So his aides elicited responses from labor unions, the American Legion, the veterans of foreign wars, Republican governors, and Republican Party state chairmen. As one aide remarked, everything was spring-loaded. And the United States Historical Society has polled the nation's history professors to determine a list of the 15 most important people of the 20th century. The list includes Winston Churchill, Thomas Edison, Albert Einstein, Henry Ford, Sigmund Freud, Mohandas Gandhi, Adolf Hitler, Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, Mao Zedong, Pablo Picasso, Pope John XXIII, Franklin Roosevelt, Joseph Stalin, and the Wright brothers. You're listening to Talking History. Atlantis, the mythical, mystical, and mysterious lost land, has been the subject of so many stories over the centuries, indeed over the millennia. But what do we really know, if anything, about Atlantis? We shall see, as for Talking History's interview of this week, Creighton historian Eileen Dugan talks with Richard Ellis.
Question: what have Plato, Jules Verne, a Nazi engineer, Indiana Jones, and the banana in common? Answer: they are all in some way related to the myth of Atlantis. The story of the lost continent has intrigued audiences for over 2,000 years. Despite the efforts of literary scholars, scientists, and mystics, we have yet to fix the supposed location of Atlantis, much less to prove its actual existence. With us today is Richard Ellis, author of Imagining Atlantis. Mr. Ellis is a renowned marine artist and has authored a number of books dealing with the sea. His work has also appeared in Audubon, National Geographic, and Scientific American. In his fascinating new book, Imagining Atlantis, Mr. Ellis focuses upon the development of the myth of Atlantis and the people who have sought the lost continent. Welcome, Mr. Ellis.
Thank you.
As a starting point, how did the legend of Atlantis begin?
It's nice that we have all the information to answer that question. In most cases of myths or stories, they sort of just appear and people start telling them, and before you know it, they've acquired the character of full-grown myths. But in this case, we know exactly how it began. Plato wrote about it. He wrote about it in two dialogues. Plato, you remember, lived around, well, not because you were there, but you remember from reading that Plato lived around 400 B.C., and in two dialogues called the Timaeus and the Critias, he wrote the story of Atlantis. He wrote where it was, he wrote who lived there, he wrote what its characteristics were, he described what it looked like, and he said what happened to it. So we know exactly where the story came from.
Well, where was Atlantis supposed to be?
Well, now, if we're listening to Plato, it was outside the Pillars of Hercules, which are the Straits of Gibraltar, outside the Mediterranean, therefore in the Atlantic Ocean, to the west of the Atlantic Ocean. And that's where Plato said it was.
And what did it look like?
It was a very, very rich country. It was enormous. He said it was larger than Asia and Africa combined. He said it had very rich fields, it had hot and cold running springs, all kinds of wonderful fruits and vegetables and grains grew there. It was a plateau surrounded by mountains, and it had a huge and very, very elaborate palace in addition to racetracks and very complicated harbors. In other words, it was a very, very elaborate and fully developed, very rich civilization.
So why, according to Plato, did it sink?
Well, he said that the people, the Atlanteans, decided to conquer the world, and they started by battling with the Athenians, of whom Plato was one. And the gods took a look at this and decided that what they really didn't need was a conquering force to take over the very nice Athenians from the warlike Atlanteans. So the gods, through an earthquake, dumped the entire city and continent of Atlantis into the ocean, and everybody there was drowned on a single day.
And is there a certain message that he's trying to get across in the story of
Atlantis?
Well,
I'm not really sure. You see, no one has interviewed Plato for some time now. And we can only guess as to what it was he was trying to do. My guess is that this was sort of a morality tale, that he was demonstrating that proud and arrogant civilizations are destined to fail or to get dumped into the sea by an angry Zeus. But as I say, the reason the myth has lasted as long as it has is because we don't really know what he had in mind. He wrote these things. They're very, very clear. We know what he said, but he didn't bother to explain, I wrote these because I wanted to make the following point.
Now, how did Atlantis come to popular attention, going from Plato to common perceptions?
Well, it was such an interesting story, especially, I think, the part about a very, very rich civilization sliding into the sea, that after Plato had written about it. And by the way, I might point out that before Plato, that is, in any of the earlier histories that were written before Plato's dialogues, the story of Atlantis is never mentioned. It's never mentioned in Greek mythology. Open any book on Greek mythology, and you will find nothing about Atlantis. So it's obviously Plato's creation. Since then, though, people have read it, and Plato, remember, is one of the seminal thinkers in Western civilization, and whatever Plato had to say, whether it was about government or the creation of the world or disappearing cities, people took and have always taken Plato very seriously. So here you have one of the Western world's most important persons, and this is a story he told, and people said, well, look, Plato said this, maybe it's true, maybe we can find the city of Atlantis. And people began writing about it and thinking about it as early as the 17th century. Francis Bacon wrote a well-known parable, again, called The New Atlantis, in which he had a lost ship finding Atlantis in what he called the South Seas. But remember, Francis Bacon was writing shortly after the British had begun their exploration of the world. And so when Francis Drake had circumnavigated the world, so the idea that somebody would find a lost continent was not all that surprising. But since Bacon, and certainly since Plato, a lot of people have decided to take whatever information they have and whatever information they can add to what they have, and they've decided to go look for it somewhere in some strange parts of the world.
Now, what are some of the more curious theories about Atlantis?
Well, there is a settlement, a Minoan settlement, in the Aegean on the island of Crete, and to the north of that there is another settlement called Akrotiri on the island of Santorini. The Minoans lived about 1500 B.C., therefore they lived about 1,000 years or 900 years before Plato. And one of the things that has always attracted scientists, or loonies for that matter, is the story of what actually happened in Santorini. Santorini was a volcanic island. around 1500 BC, it blew up. It blew up in the largest explosion, or one of the largest explosions ever known in history. In other words, the whole island blew up, not unlike Krakatoa that blew up in 1883, but it was much larger than Krakatoa, and it was an inhabited island, which Krakatoa was not. So this whole island blew up. What was a sort of a dome-shaped volcano is now a lagoon-shaped hole in the ocean. And since parts of it are left, parts of it have been excavated by archaeologists, and they found this Minoan civilization, or remnants of a Minoan civilization. It was not difficult, therefore, for these people to decide that something terrible happened to some Greeks somewhere. There was an earthquake. Well, a volcano is almost an earthquake, isn't it? And here's this very poorly understood Minoan civilization in the Aegean, which, after all, is not in the Atlantic. The Aegean is part of the Mediterranean. But what they decided, and these are serious scientists who decided this. One was called Angelos Galanopoulos, and he was a seismologist, a student of earthquakes. And another was called James Mavor, and he was associated with Woods Hole in Massachusetts. Both of them separately, although they worked together at one point, but both of them separately decided that Plato got the dates a little bit wrong and got the location a little bit wrong, but what he was really doing, they said, was describing the destruction of Santorini and also Crete. You see, Crete, which wasn't destroyed by anything except perhaps fires, Crete is still there, had an enormous palace on it known as the Palace of Knossos. And this didn't slide into the sea because it's still there. I went there to look at it at one point. It's a very large, very elaborate palace, but it certainly is still there, and it didn't slide into the sea. But what these guys decided, these are the serious ones as opposed to the crazies, but the serious ones decided that maybe Plato got the details a little bit wrong, but he must have been talking about the destruction of the island of Santorini and or perhaps somehow connected with Crete, which had the palace. Santorini didn't have a big palace on it. And Santorini is a very little island. It's only about 10 miles across. Remember, Plato said that Atlantis was as large as Africa and Asia combined. Of course, Santorini was 10 miles across. Now its whole is 7 miles across. So these are the kind of serious people that had at it, but there were, unfortunately, a lot of crazies who also decided to reinterpret what Plato said.
What about this worlds in collision theory?
Well, that was, as you know, that was Velikovsky, who wrote a book in the 50s, I think. I don't have the date in front of me here, but he wrote a book in which he attributed a lot of what had gone on in the world to the collision of Mars and Venus, which threw the Earth out of its orbit and upset it terribly. And he decided, Velikovsky decided, that this was as good an explanation for Atlantis as it was for everything else. So he decided that when this happened, which, by the way, astronomers now believe never happened, but when Velikovsky decided to write a book about it, it received enormous publicity because he also was a scientist. Einstein read the book and said, you know, it's a very good book, but unfortunately, it's totally crazy. And it was. It was because Velikovsky, like many Atlanteans after him, decided to use to be kind of fast and loose with the facts and kind of move them around as they were convenient. So he decided that this had happened, and then he made all the facts that he could recognize fit his theory. No one nowadays believed that Mars and Venus ever collided, nor do they believe that a piece of it fell into the ocean and swamped Atlantis. But that's what Velikovsky's book was about. In fact, Velikovsky's book, because it was written by a scientist, he was a doctor, an MD, but because it was written by a scientist, originally was put in the nonfiction section in bookstores, and the scientific community rebelled so that they insisted that it be put in the fiction section because they knew that it was just absolutely crazy, as Einstein said.
My favorite theory about Atlantis had to do with the banana. Could you explain that briefly?
Well, it's a very wonderful story, and it was started by a man called Ignatius Donnelly, who wrote a book called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, and he wrote it in 1881, I think. And his theory was that everything that he could see supported his theory that Atlantis disappeared somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. And he used South American hieroglyphs, and he used Inca statuary, and he used translations of of manuscripts from India, everything, which he couldn't do. He couldn't read any of these languages, but he just decided that this is what they said. And then he wrote a book in which he attempted to prove that all of these things proved that, Plato was telling the truth, and here's where Atlantis was. And one of the things he decided was that it was absolutely impossible for the banana to have gotten from the South Pacific to South America without being carried by Atlanteans, because otherwise he couldn't figure out how this might have happened otherwise, the same food growing in two completely separate places separated by the entire Pacific Ocean, at which point he used that. He used the fact that the banana does exist in these places. He used that to demonstrate absolutely unequivocally, at least to himself, that that proved that Atlantis had once been there.
How has Atlantis been depicted in literature and in film?
Well, it's always a popular element in literature. What usually happens is people who write about it, like Jules Verne in writing 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, he had Professor Aronnax and Captain Nemo marching around under the Atlantic Ocean in the ruins of a great classical Greek city, as if somehow a city that was destroyed by an earthquake would simply sink to the bottom with all of its architecture intact. And so that was what he did. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote a story called The Maracot Deep, where he had some people floating around in a sort of a ill-defined submersible. He never bothered to explain how they would breathe underwater. But when they land on the bottom, they find the Atlanteans there. The Atlanteans have somehow contrived to live underwater and survived whatever cataclysm was supposed to have destroyed their civilization 9,000 years before Plato wrote about it. And, I mean, there's a lot of people who like to use this, and it's always, not always, but it appears frequently in the movies, particularly when people want to demonstrate a lost civilization by blowing it up. It's usually in children's movies, but there's always a sort of a Greek city in the shadow of a smoking volcano, and you know as soon as you see that the way the movie's going to end is that the volcano's going to blow, everybody's going to run around screaming, and the whole thing is going to fall into the ocean.
Well, what is your opinion? Do you believe that Atlantis existed?
I wanted to. You know, I started the research for this project thinking that it sounded interesting to me, and I wanted to read what I could find about it. There have been an enormous number of books written about Atlantis. I certainly haven't read all of them, but somebody estimated there have been 10,000 books written on the subject. Well, I didn't read anything close to that, but I read a lot. And I read them with an open mind. I thought, okay, here, let me just look at the evidence and see what people have written, and people who wrote about Atlantis at Santorini, and people who wrote about Atlantis in the Antarctic, and people who wrote about it in Germany, and people who said it was in the Sahara Desert. I'll read these things, and I'll see what they say. And unfortunately for people who like to believe these things, I ended up thinking that Plato made the whole thing up, and that he did it for whatever reason. As I said, we will never know why he did it, but my guess is that he did it to tell this morality tale, number one. And two, he used elements from his own experience, whether they were the Peloponnesian Wars or the Persian Wars, or in describing the palace, was he referring to the Parthenon, which he could see, brand new, of course, it was being built when he was a child, or the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus. In fact, there was a city that did disappear into the sea when he was about 40 years old. It was called Helica. It didn't have great palaces, and it didn't have a lot of Atlanteans in it, and it certainly wasn't bigger than Asia and Africa combined, but it did happen. And so my theory is that he wanted to tell this story to make the point that he made. He was also, as you know, a political thinker, so he wanted to make the story about what a bad idea it was to think you could take over the world, and he had those people who would take over the world be destroyed and slide into the sea, and he used material from his own experience and histories that he would know. So, unfortunately, as I say, I wanted to believe it, but by the time I was finished doing the research and starting to write the book, I recognized that, or I believe now, that it was just a story, a fictional story that Plato made up, which has a remarkable durability. The fact that I could write a book about it in 1998, a story that was first told in 400 BC, is pretty interesting.
All right, well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it at that.
I was just getting warmed up.
Well, thank you. We have been talking with Mr. Richard Ellis about his new book, Imagining Atlantis.
If you're interested in the island of Atlantis, you may be interested as well in other ocean-related subjects, like the history of whaling. So as our site of the week, we've chosen the Kendall Whaling Museum in Sharon, Massachusetts. And here to tell you about the museum is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The Whaling Museum in Massachusetts is a unique place. Few attractions in New England surpass the interest and appeal of this little museum, located in Sharon, a half hour south of Boston, or a half hour north of Providence, Rhode Island. Known for its Dutch and Flemish paintings and engravings, the Whaling Museum includes tiles from the age of Rembrandt and artwork spanning 10 centuries from all over the world. There are whaleboat models, gear from New England's classic age of sail, including the world's finest collection of scrimshaw. There are several events at the museum, including films, lectures, tours, and educational programs, and there is also an annual Collector's Weekend each spring and the world-renowned Whaling History Symposium each October. You can drive to the museum from I-95 or take a commuter rail or Amtrak out of Boston or Providence. Contact the Whaling Museum in Sharon, Massachusetts for hours and programs.
Thank you, Cindy. While presidential scandals of a sexual nature have been on our minds lately, presidential fundraising scandals have been just as common in history. Here to comment on the history of fundraising scandals is historian Robert E. Much, author of Campaigns, Congress, and Courts, A Political History of Federal Campaign Finance Law. The title of Robert Much's op-ed for us today is Back to the Future of Fundraising Scandals.
As the campaign finance reform debate heats up again, Republicans will once more attack Bill Clinton as a hypocrite. Only Clinton, they'll say, would be so shameless as to deal with a fundraising scandal in his own campaign by calling for a reform of the fundraising system. The charge of hypocrisy is well deserved, but Clinton's behavior is not unique. Theodore Roosevelt behaved the same way in a similar situation 94 years ago. Roosevelt's scandal hit when it was revealed that the country's largest corporations had secretly made large contributions to his 1904 presidential campaign. In 1904, corporate political contributions aroused the same kind of apprehension that is today reserved for soft money, which is also mostly from corporations. They were legal, but were also widely regarded as improper, even dangerous. When critics accused Roosevelt of accepting corporation money during the campaign, he resorted to evasions, neither admitting nor denying the charge. When the truth came out, he responded with a stirring plea for reform. He called on Congress to prohibit all political contributions by corporations. He also proposed that federal candidates be required to publicly disclose their contributions and expenditures. After this strong beginning, Roosevelt again anticipated Clinton by taking no action whatever to turn his proposed measures into law. When reformers introduced their own bills to implement the reforms he had backed in public, he gave them no support. Then he did something that makes Clinton look like a reformer by comparison. He withdrew his support for disclosure. Roosevelt said he could not back a disclosure law because only honest candidates would obey it. Therefore, only honest candidates would suffer the disadvantage of making public what others kept secret. As an alternative to disclosure, he proposed what he called a very radical measure, public funding for presidential candidates. Reformers today praise this message as far-sighted and portray TR as the original campaign finance reformer. Reformers at the time knew better and denounced the president for his transparent attempt to derail their disclosure bill. Roosevelt was no more serious about public funding than he had been about his earlier proposals, so again he made no attempt to get a bill introduced. The relationship between wealth and power is one of the thorniest problems of our democracy. Politicians are caught between two needs: to raise money and to ensure that they, and not the money, will govern. We shouldn't be surprised when they fail to be completely consistent in the way they deal with this dilemma. At the state and federal levels, we have been enacting campaign reform laws for more than 100 years, and still we haven't eliminated worry about the political power of wealth. That experience should have taught us that the problem runs very deep and does not have a simple legislative solution. But we don't seem to have learned that lesson. Instead, we appear to have convinced ourselves that the problem could be solved if only we had a real reformer in the White House, someone like Theodore Roosevelt.
You've been listening to Robert E. Much, author of Campaigns, Congress, and the Courts, A Political History of Federal Campaign Finance Law. This is Talking History. And finally, we turn to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, where we call to your attention upcoming films, television programs, museum exhibits, or anything else of a historical nature that may be of interest to you. It used to be that tattoos were found mostly on sailors and rock singers, but these days the girl next door is as likely to be emblazoned as the biker across town. I wonder how many of them know that tattoos are a centuries-old practice with ritualistic and religious roots. That's what they would learn if they were to visit an exhibition at the Mariners Museum in Newport News, Virginia, which takes a look at body art, the fashion accessory that lasts a lifetime. Skin Deep, The Art of the Tattoo, runs through March 30th at the museum, which is near the historic sites of Colonial Williamsburg and Jamestown, Virginia. If you visit the tattoo exhibit around March 20th, you might stop by Jamestown, where for 2 days, March 20 and 21, there will be a reenactment of historic military encounters, tactics, camp life, and weaponry. For more information on the tattoo exhibit, call the Mariners Museum in Newport News, Virginia. To learn more about the military reenactment, call the Jamestown, Virginia Historic Site. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our show on women and immigration. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. We're down below the ocean.